people would ask me what I did for work, and I'd talk about the import-export stuff. I wouldn't mention anything else because I was seriously worried that someone was going to come knock on my door and I'd be arrested for fiddling around with cryptocurrency.
Hello, welcome to episode 42 of The Bitcoin Game. I'm Rob Mitchell. Would you believe I spoke to Ricardo Spagni, also known as Monero's Fluffy Pony, for 3.5 hours? I doubt either of us intended to go on for nearly that long, but that's what happened. If you're curious to learn more about Monero, one of the top cryptocurrencies in terms of market cap, and its president, you'll enjoy this episode. Oh, I'm sorry, Ricardo's not the president. I mean the creator of Monero. Okay, the lead Let's listen to this episode and find out a little bit more about Ricardo, who is in some way involved in Monero. Oh, and just one hint, when Ricardo says beta, he's saying beta in American. Ricardo.
Hey, Rob.
How are you?
Not too bad in yourself.
I'm great. It's funny to see what a sweet profile pic you have on your Skype.
Oh, yeah, it's my wife and I on top of Table Mountain from a couple of years ago.
It's just like almost over the top sweet. Is this for like talking to family or something?
No, it's my background photo on my phone as well. I don't know. I thought it was very cool when a friend of ours took the photo and it just came out really nicely. And I was like, oh, this is great. I'm going to use this as my phone photo and whatever.
It's nice. I'm just giving you a hard time a bit. I was surprised to see it.
What were you expecting, like a picture of a fluffy pony?
I didn't have any expectations, but anyway, and excuse my familiarity with you. I feel, even though we've never spoken before, I feel like I know you somehow, but I don't know. Do you get that a lot?
Yeah, I mean, I do. I get people that follow me on Twitter and then like think that Twitter is a representation, like an exact representation of me, which it is, but I mean, I'm also like very trolly on Twitter. There's a lot of stuff that I do on Twitter that I probably wouldn't do in real life.
You seem like a regular guy. I mean, you come off just, you know, like anybody down the street who's doing whatever for a living.
I'm glad you think so.
So I'm really curious about you. Like just to start off with, say, what were you doing as a teenager? What were your interests? Where'd you grow up?
So I grew up in Johannesburg in South Africa. Sort of born and raised in South Africa, but I am fortunate enough to have European citizenship as well, ancestral. So that's kind of nice. I don't know, you know, I grew up I was like a computer nerd. I don't know how else to describe it, but I was a computer nerd in the 90s when it wasn't cool. Now it's apparently cool to be a computer nerd, or so I'm told. And it was, I guess like every nerd growing up, you hit this period in your life where you do want to be cool and you want to be accepted. And so you're constantly trying to figure out how you can be part of the cool crowd. And yet the undeniable truth is you are a nerd and you can't really escape that. And so at some point in time, you've got to embrace it.
So can you give some examples?
Yeah. I mean, like my first job, when I was in high school, my first job was, I used to go and manage the computer center in my old primary school every Wednesday. And, part of that was like installing Windows 95 on new computers which was super exciting. And getting the internet to work every time it went down because we had one 56K modem and one machine that was able to connect to the internet. And I think the modem might have been a 33.6 at the time, not even a 56K. And just like, you know, that. And then during the day when I was at school, I was part of the library team. And so you'd have like an assignment. And then during one of the breaks, one or two of the breaks in a week, you'd have to go and sit in the library and, you know, kids would come in looking for books and you have to help them find the book they're looking for or help them make copies or whatever. And yet, like, at the same time, like, I knew that people were joking about those kids sitting in the library at, you know, during their break, I was one of those kids sitting in the library. So I was like, well, you know, I'm getting ridiculed, and like I know I am. And there's sort of this, there was this constant tug of war between the more nerdy you are, the more you got ridiculed. And at the same time, if I stopped being like that level of a nerd, then that wasn't great either, because, you know, that then what's the point? It's sort of wasted potential. So in the end, I chose the wasted potential and managed to just keep myself in the, like, you know, not entirely academic section of many of my classes. You know, like the girls who are like not that bright but super diligent, I would get the same marks as them, but I'd do no work. And that way I kept myself away from the sort of like, or I thought I was keeping myself away from association with those like really hardcore, studious, academic, nerdy types. Of course I wasn't. Everyone could see right through it, and they were like, oh, Ricardo's a nerd, he's just lazy. So it didn't really help anything. But, you know, I mean, like, looking back at it is really interesting. At the time, obviously, I didn't think there was any dichotomy whatsoever and thought that I was, like, completely succeeding at my intended goal.
You seem very aware of it now, but you were deluding yourself?
Oh, yeah. Oh, completely. I guess I have a tendency sometimes to do that even now. You know, I sort of go like, oh, well, I'm doing terribly at this thing. I'm failing at it completely. And then next minute people are like, oh, you did a really good job with it. I'm like, really? You know, or the opposite. I'm like, oh, yes, I'm so good at this game. I'm going to play multiplayer online. And I get my butt handed to me. And I'm like, well, okay, it wasn't as good as I thought I was.
As far as being harsh on yourself, I just figured I'd call up CoinMarketCap right now and see you're basically almost to the dollar tied for fourth place with Litecoin. So you must feel a little something good about that.
I must say that there are a lot of people who say silly things like Ricardo is the creator, or Fluffy Pony is the creator of Monero, which is incorrect. Fluffy Pony is the main developer, which is incorrect. It's Fluffy Pony's project, which is incorrect. I'm just the loudest voice, I guess, in the pond. But Monero is the culmination of the hard work of over 200 contributors across the various projects, plus a very bright and vocal community. And it's nice to be appreciated, but at the same time, Monero is a beast in and of itself. And basically, like, if I had to disappear today, Monero would still continue to make headway, just because of the strong group of contributors and the strong community that's gathered around it.
Cool. Well, I definitely want to talk a lot about Monero, but before we get into that, I'd like to hear a little bit more of your story before Monero. What was your first job? What was your path kind of toward cryptocurrency?
I've always been a developer, really. I mean, one of my earliest memories is my dad getting me a book which had a whole bunch of games in it, in BASIC, for various platforms, so Apple II and the Commodore 64 and ZX Spectrum and so on. And there would be like this, the game would be written in BASIC and it would appear on a page or two. And then there would be certain lines that you needed to modify for your system. And so you'd sit there and meticulously type it out. And then you'd have to go to the appendix to check which, you know, lines you had to change. And those are memories that I have from, you know, saving stuff onto cassette tapes using a tape recorder and learning it off that again. And those are memories from when I was like well under 10 years old.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, I was like, I got thrown into it very young, just purely because my dad was in the IT industry and was exposed to a lot of this stuff. And I was quite fortunate to have like one of the first 8086 home machines that were available in South Africa. So one of the first IBM PC clones. And that was, you know, again, like early days, you now hacking away at GW BASIC. And that sort of taught me a lot of, we're talking about really sort of old school, very limited resource machines where, the minute you start doing things in a slightly inefficient manner, you end up basically bogging everything down. So you learn a lot of like, dissecting your code, writing things in the most efficient manner possible, you tend to revisit your stuff 6 months later because, like, you're just growing in thinking ability in leaps and bounds as a kid.
So I'm curious, because I grew up, I guess had a lot of the same things you had. I grew up with a Commodore 64 and a mom who'd been, you know, programming since the days of punch cards and encouraging me. But man, I just did not have what it took to, I don't know if it's memorizing or just copying the code. I remember her copying codes from magazines for a, you know, really simple game and stuff.
Yeah.
And man, I took advantage of none of these kind of, I guess, gifts that I would love to pass on, you know, to my kids or whatever. But what do you think the difference is between me and you? Why did you gravitate and excel where I just kind of, you know, used it as a word processor?
I don't know. I mean, that's an interesting question. I think one of the things that really, really channeled all that energy was at the back of one of these very early books that, you know, with a bunch of code in it that my dad had bought me, was this game called Death Valley. And it was very stupid. You had like a little triangle, which was the ship, and you had this like valley that was generated out of ASCII art, and you had to move the ship left and right, and if it hit the walls on either side of the canyon, then you died. But there was this great backstory that was written in this book, and there were these like this beautiful sci-fi art that was part of this. And it was the last game in the book, and it was the most complex. And I struggled to get it to work. Literally, I think it probably took me, because I abandoned it and then went back and redid it from scratch because I'd lost the tape that I'd saved it on. But it probably took me a good year and a half to eventually get that working. And that sense of accomplishment when I finally got Death Valley working and I was able to fly the stupid ship up like left and right and not hit the thing and see the points go up, like, that was amazing.
Oh, you must have been ecstatic that first time.
Oh, it had felt like my arch nemesis. And then, of course, I wasn't satisfied because then I was like, well, I need to make this thing better because the graphics were terrible. And then I started looking at some of the other games that had used colors and figured out how to like add color to it and figured out how to change the icon of the ship and took my dad's, Peter Norton's assembly language programming book or IBM handbook, whatever it was, and like found the ASCII table and that to like figure out which, characters I could use. And I think a lot of that like problem solving and borrowing from other bits of code and figuring out how things work in a very, very basic level, that taught me way more than today, where you're like, well, I've got this question, I'll just punch it into Google. Oh, here's a Stack Exchange post that like just gives me the code that I can copy and paste. Well, okay, I've learned nothing.
Sure. Hey, and what age were you when you were working on this ship game?
Oh man, I probably competed Death Valley when I was like 8.5 or 9. I was very young and I was just like stupendously proud of what I'd accomplished, which really wasn't much.
Man, well, it's pretty cool. I wonder just the reward you felt, it helped motivate you in the future. But you were going to talk about high school before I kind of took you back, I think.
Even before that, like, I guess I must have been 12 and my dad was going overseas. And I decided that because my sister was like, no, she's going to write him a letter to say that he must enjoy his trip and he mustn't forget to bring her back a present. And I was like, that's a great idea. Not having the sense of like what went into him buying us a present, just like dad goes overseas and he buys us Lego or buys me Lego. I need to get in on the action that my sister's like figured out. And so instead of writing him a letter, I like wrote him a program. It was like a little electronic card with a little beep beep ASCII music and or beep beep music and whatever. I can hardly remember really the details except that it was lots of flashing colors and he had to like press enter to go through a bunch of pages to eventually get to the part where I thanked him in advance for buying me presents or whatever it was. That was probably the first actual program I wrote that I distributed to anyone. And I was like so proud of it, but there was no one I could show except my dad. And I was like, I put it on three stiffy disks, one on each, a copy on each, just in case one of the stiffy disks didn't work. And I was like, yeah, you must only look at this in the plane.
God, imagine if you had an internet to distribute your work on at that age.
Oh, yeah, I probably would have written a whole bunch of things that are even more embarrassing than an electronic letter to my dad thanking him for the presents he's going to buy me.
What's next in your life?
So high school, I learned Turbo Pascal, and I start picking up a little bit of Unix. The Unix stuff was just by and by. I had a friend who worked for a company that had a bunch of Unix servers, and I'd go sit with him at work sometimes. School ended at 2, so I'd go chill with him at work sometimes in the afternoon, and he'd like show me all the cool stuff that they have, and we'd, you know, hack away at computers and try and build them and clean them out and try build cooling systems and do all sorts of stupid things. At the time as well, I got heavily into IRC. We had an internet connection at home, again, dial-up, and I could only really use it in the evening where calls were like half price or whatever they were after 8 p.m. And so, like, most nights I'd sit on IRC for a few hours until I got shouted at and told to go to bed. I discovered South African IRC communities on Dellnet and FNet and, you know, eventually later on QuakeNet. And then there were South African IRC servers that popped up, ZANet and a bunch of others, Blabber and so on, that's sort of heading more towards the early 2000s. And I met a bunch of like-minded people on IRC that were interested in breaking things. I mean, they weren't hackers like in the movies. They were hackers like, we have shell accounts at this ISP and we've got, you know, we're trying to figure out how to break this and we're trying to figure out how to break that. And I just found immense joy in that community. And I remember going to a meetup and realizing that everyone at the meetup was like 20s, 30s, some of them were even 40s. And I was this kid and I was like the only kid there or one of a few. And I became friends with the guy that ran 2600 South Africa. And there was a South African e-zine called Forbidden Knowledge that I got involved in and wrote an article for and wrote some other articles for under pseudonyms and did all sorts of stuff. I was very involved in what was at the time the nascent South African hacking scene without really knowing it. I mean, there were a couple of people who did stuff that and they got into trouble for it. But for the most part, I guess we were kind of tame, mostly because of lack of access to information. It wasn't like the internet where you could, like the internet today, where you could go and just have the smorgasbord of information on pretty much anything. And if you're willing to spend the time and effort, you can figure out how stuff works and you can throw it into a VM and test it yourself and download pretty much anything you'd ever need. There was a lot of sort of security through obscurity where companies would and organizations would hide how their systems worked in the hope that that would somehow lead to some level of protection. That exposed me to a lot of very early cryptographic primitives, you know, because you sort of start at a systems level, but then you're very quickly exposed to, oh, we're playing with encryption or we're playing with hashing and how does this thing work? And you start fiddling. And I had the privilege in high school, in my last 2 years, there was a program called AdMaths. And AdMaths was basically if you were doing higher grade maths and you got above a certain grade, then you could apply to do this for the last 2 years for grade 11 and matric. And it was kind of like first year university maths. We had a really, really gifted maths teacher, Mr. White, who like a lot of the sort of very fundamental things that I understand now about very basic things like variance come from early lessons that Mr. White taught in ad maths in high school. And the class was tiny. There were only like 12 of us. And that was my little sort of rebellion against my desire not to be a nerd. I was like, no, I have to do ad maths because it's so cool. And I you know, there were like there were little things he did. Like we had a competition to memorize pi to as many digits as we can. There's no value in it, I guess. At least no intrinsic value, but it again teaches you. Like I was sitting at home with printed out digits of pi, trying to memorize as many as I could for absolutely no reason, except it was this competition that I was like, I just wanted to win for, just because.
Did you?
Yeah, I did.
Do you remember how many digits?
Yeah, I think it was 33.
Do you think you could ramble those off right now?
Sure, I'll go as far as I can. 3.141592653589793238462643338. I forget what comes after that.
All right. Well, that was good. I know 3.14. That's about it.
So yeah, that you know, like a lot of that exposed me to stuff that that again, it's just a way of thinking, you know, the being exposed to the BOFH and hashtag community very early on taught me a way of thinking and taught me ways of looking at systems and looking at failure modes. You know, a lot of people design systems with a view to how will the system work. And being involved in those communities early on taught me to design systems with a view to how will it break, which is it's super necessary for cryptocurrencies, and yet a lot of altcoin developers have no idea how to think adversarially. In their mind, everyone is trustworthy and everyone will basically act rationally, which is not the case.
Sure. And I'd love to hold off on the crypto part until we're done with kind of like your history part, if you don't mind.
What? Stay focused.
Well, I do want to get into all that, but I don't want to hop back and forth too many times. I don't know if it makes a difference, but.
No, totally.
So, yeah, I mean, go on. I'm just really curious.
Sure. I don't often get to ramble on about my childhood, so I'm not gonna say no.
Support the show by buying a Bitcoin keychain at bkeychain.com. This is the classic Bitcoin keychain you've seen all over the internet. It's a substantial coin-like medallion that you'll be proud to keep with you at all times. For those who love a pun in times of division, check out the Bitcoin Fork Pen at bitcoinforks.com. Bitcoin fork pens are sure to get a laugh at the next Bitcoin meetup or conference. Again, that's bkeychain.com and bitcoinforks.com.
So one of my first jobs then after pretty much towards the end of high school, my first boss, Brent Hutchinson, who ran the computer center at my old primary school, and then subsequently went and did something else, and I just sort of tagged along with him for a few years in high school and had like a 1 or 2 day a week job. And then towards the end of high school, he put me in touch with somebody else who was looking for someone to come work with him on a sort of more regular basis, so several days a week in the afternoon after school. And he had a company that sold secondhand computers. So they'd buy like used computers from offices where a corporate would replace 30 or 40 machines. They'd buy those machines, clean them up, refurbish them, and sell them to individuals. I went to go work for this company and I like cut my teeth on hardware. I mean, I'd fiddled with hardware before, but I'd blown stuff up and, you know, done stupid things like plug IDE drives in whilst the computer's running. Because what's the worst that could happen, except I get a shock. And so I sort of had this, at the time I had this respect for the electricity that flows inside the box. And I didn't really want to like fiddle with hardware too much, but now suddenly I was in a role that required it. I mean, I only worked there for like a year and a half or whatever it was until I was done with high school. But it was pretty, like, again, taught me a lot of stuff about failure modes and about cleaning cigarette butts out of computers and about building cooling systems with Peltiers because, you know, there were always these leftover bits.
What's a Peltier?
It's basically a device where when you apply current to it, it transfers heat from one side to the other side. So one side will become really cold and the other side will become really hot.
Okay.
You know, I had this vision of like, I'm just going to pile them on top of each other and then put a really big fat heat sink and, you know, bring the temperature of my what was it at the time? It was a Pentium 1, because I went from a 486 DX266 to a DX4100 to a Pentium 1. And I wanted to overclock my Pentium 1, but I needed a cooler to do this. And this was, I had this idea for like a Peltier-based cooling system. Looking back on it, I don't know, it might have worked, but it was probably nonsensical. But like, I just sat and mucked around with it and learned how to use a soldering iron and broke a bunch of stuff and burnt my processor out eventually, which was a lesson in and of itself. And then after high school, I started studying, but couldn't really, my parents couldn't really afford to, for me to go to university full time. So I did, I started studying through UNISA, which is the University of South Africa. And they offer a very, very excellent platform for remote study, where again, at the time it was all, you know, there was very little done online. It was all like letters that were sent to you and projects that were sent to you that you then have to physically, like, you know, you type out, print out, and then send back to them, and some professor had to mark. And so whilst I was doing the distance learning thing, I got my first proper job, which was as a developer, and initially started as a Delphi developer, because that was kind of the gold standard at the time. Like, so this would have been 2001. Delphi was nice, and there were some really interesting things about it. And there were some, Delphi taught me object-oriented programming more than anything else. But within, I don't know, I mean, it was very quick. By the end of 2001, yeah, I would say end of 2001, beginning of 2002, I was poached by a company, a Microsoft dev house that had just started porting applications from Visual Basic and Delphi into the newly released Microsoft.net. And so I had to learn C#, which up until that point didn't exist as a language. And again, no resources because it's brand new, except for the stuff from Microsoft. And at, like at this point in time now, I'm learning C#, and a lot of my reference points are, well, this is how it works in C++, or this is how it works in C, and this is how it works in C#. So I'm sort of by the by, because I'm going through the teething process of this brand new language, and a lot of the training material keeps referring to C and C++. I'm learning C and C++ without even realizing it. And Microsoft have adopted like patterns and practices from C++ that, you know, you learn it as a Microsoft pattern and practice, and then you go and discover 10 years later that actually it's this thing that people have been doing in C++ for like 10 years before C# even existed. And yeah, I mean, basically from there, I worked as a developer and started going up the chain and moving from a very junior developer. I hopped around between companies a bit as well, as one does, especially in the IT industry, because if you can move to another company for a better salary and a slightly bigger name tag or whatever it is, then you do. And worked for a couple of head shops where they deploy you to banks. So I had the opportunity of seeing how the banking system works as a developer, learned a whole bunch of SQL, cut my teeth on, I'd been playing around with SQL Server by then for a little while, again, because a friend of mine used it in his job and insisted on teaching me, and learned BizTalk and a bunch of other silly Microsoft applications. And at the time, like I was sort of developing developing on the Microsoft ecosystem, but I was constantly exposed to BSD as an operating system because I was still hanging around with a bunch of people from IRC who were the nascent South African hacking community. And a lot of them thought BSD was the best thing since sliced bread. At this point in time, I'm late teens, early 20s. And I'm learning BSD and I'm learning C++ and I'm learning all these things just by the by, because I'm throwing them on a machine and playing around with it and getting frustrated and trying to fix things, you know, figuring out stuff on the internet and learning protocols on the internet. And like the amount of learning that we did at that point was insane because there was a lack of tools to do things for you. I mean, there were sometimes stupid tools like Back Orifice, which was this very dumb hacking tool that let you take over a machine remotely, but it wasn't particularly sophisticated. So if you wanted to do anything sophisticated, you needed to like pre-roll that and either break through a firewall or find a way to reverse NAT or whatever it is, so that you actually have raw access to the machine behind the router or the firewall. And just that sort of level of learning is second to none, because you're living and breathing stuff. You're living and breathing C# and Transact SQL and all this other jazz during the day, and you're coming home at night and you're like talking to people on IRC and like reading text documents that get sent to you and reading e-signs, and you know, there's no YouTube and there's no like podcasts. You're just like reading and reading and reading and installing stuff on these machines that are lying around in pieces or lying in pieces in your cupboard and in your room. And you've got like three monitors on your desktop and these old clunky CRT monitors, and you've got this horrible slow network that you've set up just to like play with stuff, you know, living on 4 or 5 hours sleep because you've got to go to work in the morning, but you're up till whatever, 4 a.m. hacking away at stuff. It's definitely a learning experience. Oh, and at the same time, I'm trying to do my degree because that makes sense.
It's a computer degree, I assume.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I was doing a BCom informatics and logistics. I did the BCom. The informatics was obvious. Well, the BCom wasn't obvious. The BCom was because I'd refused to do a comp sci degree, a BSc. I wanted to do a business degree because I'm bucking the trend of like, I'm not a nerd. I can, you know, I can do other stuff too. And then the logistics was just because I needed to choose a second major, and I was like, I don't even know what this is, so I'll just choose it.
I've never heard those labels, the BCom. I'm trying to roll with you. And
so yeah, BSc is Bachelor of Science, BCom is Bachelor of Commerce. So it's basically a business degree, but you know, the informatics stuff, it was the first year that they offered informatics, and it was a more of a business oriented computer science degree. So you weren't learning to write program, and well, you did a bit of programming, but you weren't learning to write operating systems. You were learning to work with data. You were learning about data warehousing and databases and decision systems and decision making systems and all sorts of stuff like that, which actually ended up being interesting. But at the beginning, I was like, well, what have I gotten myself into? Because one of the first things I had to do was get my CSDL, my computer something driver's license. It was the most ridiculous thing ever. It was all about Windows and Office. It was so simple, and people were failing it. And I was like, wow, how can anyone fail this? It's so trivial. But it was because, you know, when you've worked with this stuff for years, it is second nature to you. And there were people coming out of school that like had never really worked with Microsoft Office. It felt like I'd done the idiot's comp sci degree. Anyway, I'm getting sidetracked. So ended up sort of going up the ranks as a developer. And then at one point when Star Wars Episode 3 was coming out, I met somebody who wanted to do a proper Star Wars extravaganza for the opening night. Because in South Africa at the time, we got movies premiering 3 months after they premiered overseas. And Ulrico, who's this guy that I'm talking about, he wanted to do the Star Wars premiere and like get sponsors, fly the stars in, because it'd be 3 months later after the normal premiere. So it'd be great. That never happened. But one thing led to another, and we started an events company on the side, because you know, we were two computer nerds that knew nothing about events. It soaked up a ton of our time. And this is now post-degree, you know, it's probably 2005, I guess, 2004, somewhere around there. And we're running comedy nights on a Wednesday at one of the jazz clubs. And we're running comedy nights on a Friday at another place. And we're getting to know all of the comedians.
Were you getting on the mic at all?
I got on the mic a couple of times. It wasn't, you know, like it wasn't really my thing. I enjoyed the management stuff more than that. But yeah, I mean, we had Trevor Noah like perform at our Wednesday nights at the Blues Room in Village Walk. The Blues Room doesn't exist anymore. Village Walk doesn't exist anymore. And Trevor Noah is now doing the Daily Show in the USA. So this is like really back in the day when like no one knew him and we didn't know what we were doing. Eventually, the company sort of fizzled out. But it taught me a lot of stuff about managing people, because everything about that company and about the stuff we did couldn't be solved technically. You couldn't write a program to manage the comedians. You couldn't write a program to take money in at the door or to negotiate for a portion of the bar tab. Everything had was about communication and face-to-face interaction and negotiation. And it taught me a bunch of really, really invaluable lessons. At any rate, I ended up, I was still working full-time as a developer. I eventually became the lead architect at a company and moved up to managing the development division at a company that had just been acquired by this much larger listed company. So the listed company went and bought this company and a bunch of people left, and they headhunted me to go head up the development division. That was my first exposure to very senior management, to being disconnected almost from the boots on the ground, day-to-day running stuff, and to being exposed to the inner workings of a listed corporate in South Africa and all the ugliness that goes along with that. And I met my wife at the time, and but just before that, met my wife, and eventually we got married whilst I was working there. Maybe a year after we'd gotten married, I was so burnt out, I couldn't do it anymore. And my wife said to me, well, why don't you leave and we can start our own thing? And I was like, no, can't do that. Need the security of the regular monthly paycheck. It's just not possible. And she said, no, well, don't worry. I'll carry on working. So we'll have a regular monthly paycheck and you'll be able to start something new. So I said to her, well, what should we start? Like, I don't really want to be a freelance developer. Not that I've really progressed much beyond that, although I guess upper management is beyond that. But I just didn't really want to sit and hack away at PHP for the rest of my life. And she said, well, because at the time we just had this huge, like, it wasn't a fight. It was a debate, because she went to go get her nails painted twice a month at some ridiculous cost. And the gel-based nail polish would last for 2 weeks, and then she'd have to go get it done again at some ridiculous cost. And we just had this whole like discussion about it would be so much better if she could get the kit herself and just paint her own nails at a vastly reduced cost, and they'd still last 2 weeks. So she said to me, well, you know, that thing we just spoke about, what if we imported the nail stuff and sold it? And I was like, but who are we going to sell it to? And she was like, no, you know, we'll figure out who wants to buy it. We'll canvas salons and we'll go to stores and whatever and see how we can sell to them. And so we did. I quit my job. She didn't quit hers. And we started up this import-export company. And it was something that we had no clue what we were doing. We went down all sorts of ridiculous roads. We spent money that we didn't have to. We saved money where we didn't need to. And we learned more about import-export, gel-based nail polish, knockoff bikinis, and slimming tools that don't work, because obviously this is me we're talking about. I'm not exactly the thinnest guy. Then anyone should ever in their right mind know. And we built the company up to a point where I was still, there was a whole bunch of stuff that I was doing that was development oriented. I mean, I was writing stock management systems because I couldn't find anything that like really fit the bill. And I was writing tools to pull reports from MySQL and doing stuff like that. But effectively, we started up a company that did import-export. It wasn't an IT company at all. And it became reasonably successful. And it afforded us the opportunity to move down the coast to this little coastal town, because my wife says I'm not allowed to call it a village, even though there are only 30,000 people and one traffic light in the whole of town. We moved to this little coastal town called Plettenberg Bay. That was now a few years back, I think 2011, beginning of 2012. And now at the time, I'd been playing around with this thing called Bitcoin, which I'd read a Slashdot article and some of my friends, because I ran a meetup in Cape Town called Zero X Coffee. And there were people at Zero X Coffee that would talk about Bitcoin, and I sort of got very interested in it. And so we moved down the coast, and the idea was the company is running itself. We don't need to live in Cape Town where the company is, because we have a manager who we've given a portion of the company to, and he runs the day-to-day operations. So we only need to like go in once a month, and even that we can do over the telephone to have meetings. There's very little that we need to do on a day-to-day basis. So what we're going to do is take advantage of this. I'm like, you know, early 30s. My wife's late 20s. Well, obviously she's early 20s. I would never reveal her real age. And we're moving down the coast to like semi-retire.
Is your wife in the room?
She's not. Otherwise, I'd probably get a smack.
I thought you just got an evil glance or something, and that was the no. change. Okay.
And the idea was like, we're going to semi-retire. I'm going to focus on new projects, because right now our entire income stream and revenue stream is based in South Africa. So I'm going to focus on new projects that allow us to like, you know, build revenue overseas. And I, at this point in time, I'd been playing with mining Bitcoin and buying a bunch of Bitcoin overseas, because I sort of viewed it as a way to move money in and out the country without needing to deal with all of the regulation, or at least without having to wait for regulatory hurdles to get jumped over. I could just move money and then sort out the regulation at the end of the year in tax season. And she was going to focus on the nail stuff. When we started it, we launched an online store, and the online store never really did tons of traction. And now we suddenly had free time and money. And so she wanted to rebrand the online store and do some proper advertising for it and start taking proper photos with, because she hired some staff here and so on, and start like coming up with ways to improve that as a part of the business, and not just sort of selling to distributors and to companies, but to start really focusing on selling to end users and that part of the business. And I was going to focus on like this Bitcoin thing and see like, how can we make money from the Bitcoin thing? Because, or how can we at least use Bitcoin to make money from people overseas? We moved down here to semi-retire. And at the beginning, we're only working the equivalent of 3 hours a day. That's it. You know, so it's going to be like 15 hours a week. And the rest of the time, we're going to play squash and go to the beach and drink cocktails and you know, have people over for supper. And yeah, it didn't work that way, because within like 6 months, we were both so busy that we were working like 16-hour days. Mm-hmm. So much for semi-retirement. That was late 2011, early 2012. That's how I ended up going down the rabbit hole.
Did you figure out the initial goal with moving your money? That sounds like a real use case. Like, were you actually doing that?
Like, I guess as a lot of people do, I had this idea that mining could somehow be super profitable, not realizing that South Africa's electricity costs are not too cheap. But I went down that road and eventually spent a bunch of money on Butterfly Labs equipment that I never got. Well, no, I think I did get some of it, but there's still stuff that I've, there are ASICs I've bought that I've never received. What can you do? But yeah, like I focused very much on the mining initially. I would wire money overseas to Mt. Gox to buy Bitcoin with the sole purpose of buying stuff with Bitcoin. One of the earliest things I bought was access to a closed source miner that was faster than any of the open source miners that were out there. I mean, like that's something that still happens now in the altcoin space all the time, but that was happening early on in Bitcoin as well.
Closed source miner, you're talking about hardware or software?
Software. So, you know, people would take the open source miner, they would figure out a bunch of ways to improve it, because again, this was early days where GPU mining was like very much in its infancy, and people would figure out ways to improve it, and they couldn't release the source code if they wanted to make money from it.
Sure.
So they would use it themselves, obviously, but they would also then, you know, there'd be these like hush-hush discussions on IRC where it'd be like, you know, there's like a 30% speed up if you use this miner. And like, you can buy it from this guy for like a mere 50 Bitcoin. It's just one block, you know? I mean, it's 50 Bitcoin. What's 50 Bitcoin between friends?
Did it make economic sense for them to sell this when they're weakening their own mining position, or how does that work?
Yeah. I mean, they could easily sell it to like, whatever, let's call it 20, 30 people. And let's say you're selling it at 100 Bitcoin a pop. I mean, you're effectively getting a good 50 to 60 blocks worth of mining reward. And you're getting that up front. So whether a bunch of other people figure this out at the same time, and because they will, other people will figure it out. But whether a bunch of other people figure it out at the same time, or someone leaks your binaries, or someone just goes and sells them on, because that happened too. They'd sell them on to other people.
Right.
You wouldn't care, because you'd already made more from selling that miner than you will if you like mine on your own equipment. A lot of the guys hacking away at this stuff didn't have access to massive GPU farms. You know, this was sort of a much safer way of making money than trying to find a partner that had a GPU farm that they could work with.
Okay, so this is all solo mining?
No, this is pool mining. You know, I know there were pools that existed already. Like, this is sort of around the time where Litecoin comes onto the scene, because Litecoin was end of 2011. But before Litecoin, and I guess this is something that a lot of newcomers don't really know, Litecoin wasn't really the first cryptocurrency to use script as a hashing algorithm. There was Tenebrix, and then Tenebrix was basically a massive scam. And that's like a discussion for another time. But Tenebrix like tanked very, very shortly after it launched because of it being a massive scam. And somebody went and relaunched it as Fairbrix. And Fairbrix was like the fair relaunch of Tenebrix. But Fairbrix never really took off. And then Litecoin, like those two begat Litecoin. And Litecoin took off just because it was like Fairbrix, but not with a stupid name. I mean, a lot of the sort of dodginess at the time had to do with, oh, there's no GPU miner for Tenebrix, and yet the difficulty on the network is high enough that there has to be a GPU miner. And everyone looked at ArtWars, and ArtWars went, well, no, I don't have a GPU miner, I promise. And there was a lot of like dodginess like that. Coupled with that, we were a little bit concerned with how libertarian some of the stuff was going, and we didn't really want to be involved in projects where the main thrust was to overthrow governments, because we felt like that would lead to trouble and to attention, where at that point in time, no one really knew if cryptocurrencies would have longevity. So there was a lot of like, not just myself, but other people as well, we were bouncing around between pseudonyms, and we were very careful not to let people know that we were involved with cryptocurrency on any level. People would ask me what I did for work, and I'd be like, I'd talk about the import-export stuff. I wouldn't mention anything else, because I was seriously worried that someone was going to come knock on my door and I'd be arrested for fiddling around with cryptocurrency. Mm-hmm. It was probably a silly concern, but I mean, at the time, no one really knew the lay of the land. You know, it's like being a Tor developer, like around the time Silk Road launches. You know, you're sort of going, well, Tor only really seems to be used for malicious stuff. What do we do? But it's not. I mean, there's, you know, all of these projects, Bitcoin, Tor, everything, regardless of what use cases they are, they end up with. They don't start off, and then they're never built out with malicious use cases in mind. But you do end up panicking, because it's not always clear that a law enforcement officer or a government will view it that way, as altruistically as we view it ourselves. At any rate, sort of like dabbled with a bunch of stuff, and was heavily involved in the mining stuff for quite a while, and I wanted to run my own farm. But, you know, I ran a bunch of rigs, but I realized pretty early on that South African electricity prices were just never going to be competitive, no matter what deal I struck with the government or with the electricity provider. Started producing towards the end of, middle of 2013. So this was during the altcoin boom, when there were like a bunch of really scammy altcoins and really stupid altcoins being created. I came up with a design for a flat packable open air frame, stackable frame for GPU rigs, and started selling those. It went pretty well. We had hiccups at the beginning, especially with people choosing land-based shipping, which went on a boat and took like 3 months. And they never read the thing that said this takes 3 months. And so they expected it to take like 2 days. And so we had people like, you know, ordering and choosing the world's slowest shipping and then being very surprised when it happened to be the world's slowest shipping. Having been in the import-export game, I wasn't really used to dealing with end users or with customers. I was used to dealing with distributors, where you send them 1,000 units. And if the 1,000 units don't arrive, you don't care because you've got insurance and they've got insurance. And if 1,000 units arrive and 10% are broken, you don't care because you've got insurance and they've got insurance. And now we had a scenario where people were opting out of shipping insurance, and we had to get like a very broad insurance cover. And then we had to put in claims on an individual basis. And, you know, again, when you're claiming for 1,000 units, you don't really care if it takes 4 months because you get paid out eventually. And now you're claiming for an individual unit, and insurance take a week and a half just to process the claim and say, yes, we will pay out. And then they go, yes, we will pay out. And you go running back to the customer and you say, oh, insurance have said, yes, they will pay out. And so we'll front you the money. And then when insurance pays us, then we don't care. It'll be whenever. And so I got to deal with lots of really interesting and frustrated people in the Bitcoin space. And I guess like the other thing that I was exposed to then were people that had paid in Bitcoin. And so they paid in a cryptocurrency that they couldn't reverse. So if they didn't get their shipment, then what was their recourse? They had no recourse. You know, the people that paid with PayPal, they could at least go and open a PayPal dispute, which they invariably lost, but like at least they had at least they had recourse. But the cryptocurrency users were like, so I paid you, you sent me a tracking number, I see it's tracking, but I'm not expecting to wait this long, and so I'm very upset. But what can I do? And you'd be like, oh, I'm so sorry. Do you want me to claim from insurance? I can't really. Or do you want me to just, how about I just give you 10% and then like you just wait for it to arrive? Whereas the people who paid with PayPal that actually had a recourse were the ones that were throwing a tantrum and like refused to work together with you to figure out a solution. The ones that didn't have a choice were like, okay, let's figure out a way that works for everyone. So that was in and of itself quite interesting to see. That business wound down partly because there were other manufacturers that started doing the same thing, but also mostly because it's very difficult, like shipping out of South Africa, where most of your clientele are in the States and Europe, and trying to compete with shipping times from someone else with a more expensive product but local. We did set up a warehouse in the US and in Germany, and we did start shipping stock from there. But I mean, at that time, it's, you know, reputational damage has already been done, so people automatically assume that your shipping is slow, and they'd rather get it elsewhere. That happened at the beginning of 2014. At the same time, like whilst that business is now winding down because we've basically shipped the orders and we, we're not getting tons of orders in. So we sort of started shutting that down because there was no real point in running it if we're only going to get 5 orders a week or 10 orders a week. And we started, there was a mining farm that asked us to do a rack-mounted design for their rack-mounted GPUs. So we did. We designed that, and they made us sign they signed an exclusivity agreement with us where they're our only customer. That business is somewhat dormant. But one of the things that it got me interested in was it got me exposed to a lot of altcoiners, where I had really not been very interested in altcoins up until that point. And it got me exposed to a lot of the difficulties within altcoin communities, where they want their coin, their altcoin, to be broadly accepted, but it's quite difficult. And it's largely pointless now, especially with companies like Shapeshift. Where's the value? You know, anyone who holds Wafflecoin can still use it to pay on a site that accepts Bitcoin. There's almost no point now in because of the simple rails between things in even caring about it. But at the time, a feather in the cap of any altcoin is to be added onto some sort of payment system so that merchants can start accepting it. It got me very interested in the disconnect between merchants who even now still go, you know, well, we're willing to accept Bitcoin and maybe something else. Altcoiners in the midst of a pump and dump who are going, oh, I need to use my waffle coin to pay everywhere whilst it's still worth money. I'm bag holding a lot. And because I was exposed to all of these, this whole sort of altcoin space, because late 2013, most of the GPU, all of the GPU mining was altcoins. I had a guy that I met that I'd become friends with who popped up beginning of 2014 and said, have you heard about this Bitcoin thing? And I was like, yes, of course. Everyone knows Bitcoin. It's that stupid coin that black died. It didn't do anything. And he's like, no, there's another Bitcoin. And so I was like, oh. And he says, and it's not based on Bitcoin's code. And I went, oh. And he said, and it's like anonymous. And I went, oh. And that's how I discovered CryptoNote. Sort of like looked at it, mined a bunch, fiddled around with it, but was busy as well. So I didn't really have time to play much until Monero was launched, because that was my other big gripe with Bitcoin, was the fact that 83% of it had already been mined by the time I discovered it and everyone else did. And that's like, you know, talk about a pre-mine. It puts everything else to shame. It puts Dash to shame. So when this guy on Bitcoin Talk, thankful for today, launched, did a fair relaunch of it called BitMonero, I was like, cool, he has a fair relaunch. This is great. This is, you know, it's the technology that I'm interested in, but without the 83% scammy pre-mine. And started mining it sort of day one-ish. I struggled a bit in day one, so really started mining it in day two on Amazon AWS slices. I knew this thing's going to hit an exchange, and when it hits an exchange, it's going to spike, and I'm going to be able to offload like all the stuff that I'm mining. So I'm just like mining as much as I can with a view to dumping it. At the same time, I'm getting sucked into the technology because I'm struggling with stupid things. I'm trying to automate my mining slices, and so now I'm trying to figure out this RPC stuff. It isn't documented anywhere, and I'm trying to go through the code, which has got no comments in it at all. And I'm struggling with like this, and I'm struggling with that. I'm trying to compile it, yeah, and I'm trying to eke out a little bit of performance there. And I'm doing all this stuff, and I'm slowly getting sucked into the technology whilst wanting to just like dump it on the first exchange where it lists, because they always spike when they hit an exchange. So this goes on for a little while. We discover that there's a flaw in the hashing code. That is not accidental. We fix that and make the stuff faster.
When you say it's not accidental, who is benefiting?
So when Bitcoin was announced on the scene and it was like, oh, look, here's Bitcoin. We've just accidentally discovered it, as the sock puppet account said. There was this 83% that had been mined, but excuse for it was, oh no, it's existed since 2012 since 2012, but it existed only on the dark web. And so that's why you haven't heard about it. Everyone uses it on the dark web. There are many sites that accept Bitcoin on the dark web. And of course, everyone on Bitcoin Talk is going, what? No, they aren't. I've never heard of this thing. You know, but they doubled down on it, and they were like, well, of course it is. Look, You can look at the dates on the Block Explorer and see that they go back to 2012. Clearly, this must have been used on the dark web. And just because you don't know about it doesn't mean that it didn't exist. And what they'd actually done is they'd used this crippled miner. So they'd purposely taken a variable that only needed to be, or a constant that only needed to be calculated once in a loop, before a loop rather. And they put it inside the loop. So inside this loop that ran like 1,000 times, it was recalculated each time. And so this made mining 10 times slower than it actually needed to be out the box. Mm-hmm. There were other improvements like over and above that, but just at a very, very basic level. And because they had this, because there was this miner that was purposely crippled, for want of a better word, they were able to generate 2 years worth of blockchain history very quickly by a combination of false timestamps and running the system clock at double the speed, and also this much faster miner. So in their mind, what they thought was anyone who opens it and then looks at the hash rate, the hash rate that you can compute from the difficulty will go, oh, there must have been thousands of people mining this over 2 years. Clearly, the hash rate chart shows that. When meanwhile, what the hash rate chart showed was that they had like 10 machines mining it, just with a much faster miner. And so no one really bought into the scam, but that it was very cleverly engineered. Probably one of the best altcoin scams that I have seen in terms of engineering brilliance ever.
And you discovered this extra calculation in the loop?
You know, just to back up a second, at the time what's happening is, Thankful for Today is being a gigantic douche nozzle. He's insisting on stuff like Bitmonero needs to be merge mined with Bitcoin. The community's pushing back. There's eventually this vote that happens where all the miners vote based on a version number in the block, a miner version. He makes the default yes. We freak out. He changes the default to abstain. Eventually, the votes are tallied, and they're clearly no, but he insists on just doing it anyway. So there's this massive falling out where the community realizes this guy is a gigantic douche nozzle. He's never going to listen to us as a community, so we should fork it away. And myself and six others fork the project away from him. We change it from Bitmonero to just Monero, because Bitmonero is actually a kind of a stupid name, because Monero in Esperanto means coin. So literally the name of it was Bitcoin in Esperanto. So so we change it, you know, we fork it away, we create a new GitHub repo, we create a register, Monero.cc is the website, and we sort of like, you know, we put our foot down and we like, you know, look, you guys can run Thankful for Today's code, or you can run our code where we're not going to be merge mined with an 83% pre-mined scam ever. And so the community follows us.
When was this?
This was 3-4 weeks after launch. It was very, very early on.
But the date is?
It was launched on the 18th of April. We registered Monero.cc on the 23rd as a David registered it as a sort of like information portal. And that became the main Monero website within a couple of weeks after that, when Thankful for Today just ended up basically rejecting the community and deciding that he was going to do his own thing.
Was he ever known as a real person, or did you know who he was?
No, he subsequently disappeared and hasn't logged into Bitcoin Talk since the end of 2014. No one knew who he was, but we're fairly confident that he was just one of the Bitcoin shills or one of the Bitcoin scammers dressed up as another account. So, you know, not even anyone particularly interesting, just sort of one of the scammers trying to have an additional coin that they can earn money from. At any rate, so this whole thing sort of blows up, and now we've got myself and six other people who, well, we don't know each other. You know, we know each other kind of by the by, because we've seen, we recognize the names from Bitcoin Talk, but we're not friends. You know, we've never worked together. We have no idea if the people that we're with are, or that we've forked this thing with, are scammers. Now we're all sharing passwords for the Monero Bitcoin Talk account that we've just created, and for the GitHub. the GitHub user, and we like, at this point in time, we honestly have no idea if the other six people in the room, so to speak, are scammers or thieves or idiots or brilliant wizards. We have no idea. So we're being very delicate around each other and making sure we don't irritate each other because we don't know each other's personalities. We have no idea what will, you know, like what'll make someone rage quit or like delete the GitHub account or whatever. So we're just very tenderly walking around each other and trying not to call each other idiots when we say something idiotic. At the same time, we have no idea what the what to do with this altcoin that we've just adopted without really wanting or intending to. And it's kind of like, I've used this analogy before, it's like a baby being put on your doorstep and someone rings the bell and runs away and you open the door and you're like, oh dear. And now you know, you want to go hand this baby in to child protection services, but at the same time, you know that it'll probably get like bad parents. And that's bad. So you're like, well, okay, I said, you know, like we can raise it because at least we know we won't do a terrible job or we'll do a slightly better job than the next person. And we don't really want to see this child get raised by parents who are scammers, even though we might be scammers ourselves and we just don't know it yet. And so what we'll do is we'll just raise it because we hope that we can do a slightly better job. And so now we have this altcoin and it's C++ and some C, which is great, but it's not Bitcoin's code, which we're familiar with at least. We don't really know what we're doing. And some of us are developers and some of us aren't. And some of us have some familiarity with cryptocurrency and cryptography and some of us don't. And we really honestly have not a single clue what it is like to run an altcoin. The code has almost no comments. There are parts of the code that are shocking. That need to be like refactored and understood. Just trying to get to grips with it is painful enough. And then there's, you know, the fact that there are massive concepts in this, like ring signatures, which we are largely unfamiliar with and we need to understand. So there's this like mad scrabble for like, you know, trying to prove to the community that we are much better than Thankful for Today and we understand the community and we're listening to them. And please don't like kick us out the tribe and go with somebody else because we think we can do a good job. But also we're not a team of seven developers, so we need to like build a community. And there's no GUI and the community's already asking like, you know, saying that we need a GUI and there's no pool software. So we need to write mining pool software or find someone to write it. And we don't even have a logo. We don't have a website. We don't have a forum. You know, we honestly have no idea what we're doing. And so we're fumbling around in the dark. And we eventually we start to get things together a little bit by the time July 2014 rolls around. You know, things are starting to like come together. But okay, cool. We find these two Polish guys who we somebody writes pool software. We get a logo. We find these two Polish guys who are willing to help us design the GUI. Somebody writes a couple of people start writing GUIs and even release GUIs, like third-party GUIs. But like the main core one, we find these two Polish guys. They start, we make wireframes. We start producing the elements. They actually start writing the GUI code with me. And the three of us, like the two of them and myself, were like hacking away at the GUI the whole time because obviously this is very important. People can't possibly work with just a command line interface. And then September 2014 rolls around and the Monero network is attacked by a very sophisticated attacker. And at this point in time, I mean, you must understand like Monero has got a tiny market cap. It's hit Poloniex, spiked, I sold a bunch, and then it dumped back down. And Monero is like relatively worthless. Why anyone would even have any interest in attacking it is quite beyond me. But these attackers find a bug in a piece of C code. And in order to exploit it and fork the network, they need to create a block with more than 512 transactions. And because Monero has got this dynamic block size, they have to like spam the blockchain until the block size is big enough for them to do this. So we see this like spam attack come in and we raise the fee. We get all the miners to raise the fee. And they just keep going. They sort of double down.
How does that work? How do you get all the miners to change the fee?
Well, there's like 3 mining pools at the time. I mean, like, it's really not difficult. You know, you send a message to one in Bitcoin Talk, the other one's on IRC, and the third one you email. There you go.
And they all believe that there's a threat. And
they can see the spam attack happening, and they're like, well, cool. I mean, they're getting mining fees, which is nice.
Yeah.
but they, there's obviously a systemic risk, because our first thought is, oh, someone's spamming the blockchain to make it grow really big. And if they do this, then it's going to look bad for Monero, because Monero is going to end up with like a gig a week, and just because someone's spamming the blockchain for relatively cheap, and we can't do that.
What was the cost of the attack, do you think?
The fees at the time were really low, and Monero was worthless. So, at the beginning, not very expensive. Once we increased the fee, it became more expensive for them. They probably spent a couple of $1,000s at least in fees, just building up to the attack. Mm-hmm. And there was a great deal of sophistication, because they had to release like multiple blocks across the network, all with an incorrect or with a hash that was calculated on transactions number 513 and 514 that could not be validated. So this ends up being a gigantic mess, and the network forks. The network aligns itself towards a single chain, you know, as in any good proof of work cryptocurrency, and it does it within about 30 minutes. But the lesson for us as the Monero core team and as contributors, because by that stage we had a bunch of contributors that had we drawn to Monero just by, just because. And the lesson for us was that we are working with a piece of technology that we actually, like the inner workings of which we haven't really gone through. We're working with code that we're assuming is good, but we haven't really gone through it. There's a lack of comments. There's a lack of really anything, and of rigor. And yet, instead of focusing on that, you know what we're doing? We're working on a GUI. People don't need a GUI. They need a cryptocurrency that can't be forked at a whim. They need a cryptocurrency that is going to protect and defend their money, because what's the point of a flashy, beautiful GUI with one that's made from fantastic wireframes and beautiful elements if your money can get like stolen, or your ability to use the service can be denied by an attacker? That's like not an acceptable scenario. So we stop all work on the GUI. We completely halt it, because the Polish guys were not interested in doing it if like I wasn't going to work with them, and there wasn't the possibility of them raising money later on, because we'd already spoken about a crowdfunding system at that stage. We start talking to the contributors that are around, and we start saying to them, like, you know, this is what we need to do. I go out and sort of start actively looking for people who are contributing to open source projects and who know C, because we're mostly C++ developers. And I find someone who is interested in contributing and who is willing to go and look at a lot of the low level C stuff and comment it. I mean, this bug was in a piece of C code, not in a piece of C++. So, you know, slowly we start like getting through this stuff, refactoring, adding comments. One of the other big problems at the time was there was the Monero blockchain. When you started up the Monero daemon that connects to the network, it would load the entire blockchain into memory. Now the blockchain is starting to hit like on disk, and in its sort of unpacked state, it's starting to hit like a good 8 gigs. And that means that if you don't have 8 gigs of memory, you can't use Monero. So we're starting to really hit the edge of usability, even disregarding the fact that we don't have a GUI. Even for command line users, we're starting to really make it difficult. We have no 32-bit Windows version, so it's basically like the only way you can use it now towards the end of 2014 is command line interface, 64-bit only, and that's the end of that. So we're really now going back to basics and going back to like, let's figure out how everything works. Let's get a handle on this code base. Let's polish it up. Let's clean out the ugly bits and let's really get to a point where this thing can be used and can have features added to it instead of just slapping lipstick on a pig and hoping for something to come of that. We go down this road and we start attracting more contributors because it is like the ultimate nerd project. You come along and you're like, well, but the Bitcoin ecosystem has got so many projects I can contribute to and it's so mature. And here's this other thing which is broken. Like, I don't know how else to describe it. You know, it's almost a year old and you need 8 gigs of RAM to run it. So that's not really acceptable. And people start pitching up to like hack away at it. And, you know, we make a couple of other good decisions by accident. We decide to use LMDB as the database. And Howard Chu, who is a very well-known developer and person in the open source space, he's one of the people behind OpenLDAP. He is the creator of LMDB. So I find him on IRC and I'm like, hi, I work on a cryptocurrency called Monero and we want to use LMDB. And he's like, oh, that's cool. And I'm like, so can I bug you, you know, when we have questions? And he's like, okay. So I do, I bug him like every time we have like a question about LMDB. And eventually we get to a point where we've managed to get the thing working, but we can't get it working on 32-bit, like at all. And because there's like a fork for 32-bit, but it's really ugly. And so I go and I'm like, yo, Howard, come on. Like, you know, we need help with this. They're struggling with the 32-bit thing. And Howard just starts getting involved in Monero. You know, no real reason other than like he wants to make LMDB better and he wants to improve Monero because he has this open source project using one of his open source projects. And wouldn't it be cool if?
Today's magic word is over, as in listener rewards for the LTB network are over. But if your idea of fun is entering the magic word over at letstalkbitcoin.com, enter over to claim your share of happiness for doing that. And are we still late 2014?
This is not 2015.
Can I stop you then?
Yes, you can.
Because I'm really curious when our paths almost crossed. When I had started doing this podcast in late 2014 and I interviewed Joseph von Perling, and boy, a lot of the time was talking about Monero, and he talked about a game where you could earn Monero called Crypto Kingdom.
Yes.
Was that a major thing or just kind of like a small little experiment? Or
Crypto Kingdom was, or is, it is, it exists still. Restore, who is quite well known in this space, he had this vision for a game with almost with a real life economy, not real life like in real life, but an economy that modeled real life, and was sort of open ended, you know, like a game that was set in like the medieval, like a medieval world, but it was, there were no limits. If you wanted to start a business and charge people for stuff, you could. And you know, you wanted to start an insurance company, you could. You could basically do whatever you wanted within this world, and you had absolute economic freedom, as long as you accept the fact that there will be disasters and that there will be things that'll happen. That the game master might introduce. And the core currency within this world is Moneritos, which is, you know, very small Moneros. And so to get in and out of the economic system, you have to use Monero. You have to use Monero because it still exists. And it started off as a game that was played like with spreadsheets and a thread in Bitcoin Talk. So like Google Docs spreadsheets and Bitcoin Talk. And it eventually developed into an actual game with a website and a thing and an IRC channel and a bot and all sorts of stuff. So it's really like expanded. It's a small group of players, relatively speaking. I mean, we're not talking about thousands of players. It's a relatively small group of players. It's not a very, it's not one of those visual games where you like have a big 3D interface that you walk around. You know, it's a lot of it is about playing in this economic world. And I mean, there is a story and there are characters and people die and, you know, pass their money and their legacy onto their children and all sorts of stuff. And the system's continuously evolving. But it is effectively an open-ended economic system where you can, like in real life, if you're savvy enough, you can become rich in this game. Whether that translates into being rich in real life, I guess, depends on how much liquidity there is in the game. It was a big component, a big way to draw people in who were interested in that, interested in economics and in ways that that stuff like this would work. You know, regardless of all the way the game dynamics would work, regardless of the currency, the internal currency. So that's still going, that's still working, and it's. You know, I mean, like anyone who's interested in stuff like this, I definitely encourage you to check out Crypto Kingdom. There's a website and there's a Bitcoin talk thread. It's CryptoKingdom.me, CryptoKingdom.me. I'm hesitant to say it's a lot of fun because there's obviously a steep learning curve. But, you know, once you're in that and you're past the learning curve, it doesn't even require that much effort. You know, you can build your own little empire with relatively little time spent, and I think it's been good because typically when an altcoin decides, or when somebody in an altcoin decides that they want to add to the ecosystem, they'll, I don't know, create a gambling website or do something stupid like that. It adds to the ecosystem, but only within reason. Crypto Kingdom has been and is something that adds an element to the ecosystem that I haven't really seen in any other altcoin. Dare I say it, I haven't even seen anything like Crypto Kingdom for Bitcoin. And it's not about it. It's not a flashy thing. It's a, you know, about the game dynamics and about the economy more than anything else, which is, I guess, atypical of a lot of Monero projects. You know, less flash and more substance. Flash and prettiness can come later. Just make it work and then make it work well.
Okay. And at the same time, right after interviewing Joseph, who I'd met before that at meetups and stuff here in Los Angeles, he said, oh, there's this guy in town you got to interview. His name's Fluffy Pony, and he has this, you know, currency call or crypto, whatever, called Monero. And because we just talked about it, I wasn't really wanting to get another Monero interview going so quickly. But I was honestly a little like nervous, kind of like, what is this subversive dude? You know, sounds kind of scary. So when I finally saw who you were, it was not what I pictured.
I also, by and large, at the beginning thought that, you know, my work in Monero is probably going to get me thrown in prison or something. And hey, it probably still will. Who knows? But I think that, you know, I've definitely matured a lot in my understanding of the legalities around something like this. And at the end of the day, you know, Monero is just code, and code is speech, and speech is free in most countries. All we do is write the code, we write the tools, we don't write the use cases for it. That's kind of the thing that I take to bed at night and, you know, comfort myself with.
Gotcha. So I threw you off track a bit. You would just work with, and I already forgot the protocol that you got the guy to actually help you with.
So yeah, we sort of like throughout 2015, a lot of the focus was on the nitty gritties, on getting Monero, you know, going back to that whole thing of like make it work and then make it work well. The focus in 2015 was definitely how do we make it work, and there were so many. There were so many things that that we really needed to focus on, you know, little bits and pieces, things that we, not even little bits and pieces, like large things that we needed to focus on. And one of the big things was this like blockchain database and getting it out of memory and getting it into a format that could actually be run on computers all over the world. I mean, the amount of effort that went into it was really, really just stupendous. And a lot of it initially was done by a guy called Thomas Wingett. And Thomas, like, spent a lot of time just sort of building out a very broad, open class to access the blockchain in general, and then doing implementations for LMDB and also for BerkeleyDB. The other thing was, of course, the fact that you couldn't run Monero in the background. You had to run it in the foreground. We had to bring 32-bit support back, and there was a whole bunch of other stuff that we needed to do. And that was just like in terms of sort of actual development. In terms of improving Monero's privacy, there was work ongoing with that as well. We have a bunch of researchers that hack away at Monero from a research perspective, and they're called the Monero Research Lab. And the Monero Research Lab were also trying to figure out ways to improve Monero's privacy, see where the holes were, how we could improve it. Because now we're fixing the code to make it more stable. But what good is stable code if Monero doesn't achieve its intended goal, which is to be private? And so there was they made recommendations for ways to improve and fix a whole bunch of issues with the CryptoNode protocol. They also created and developed and invented a new cryptographic scheme called RingCT, which is based on confidential transactions. And you know, these were all pushed out during the course of 2015 from an academic perspective. We still have to take it and actually like implement it, and then, you know, like go through the rigmarole of hard forking and all that, which we did, which we eventually did. So like 2015 was really the knuckle down, make it work, a part of Monero's history. 2016 was where we started to go back into things like the GUI. We had a fundraiser for somebody to start working again in the GUI. At the beginning of 2016. And basically 2016, a large part of it has been not only adding things like RingCT, but also focusing on improving the usability of Monero, improving the performance and efficiency, and then getting the GUI working, which we eventually released after working on it the whole of 2016. Initially just part-time, but then, you know, some more contributors started clustering around it and working on it towards the end of the year. We eventually managed to get it out in beta form towards the end of 2016. So that's kind of where we're at. And by and large, despite all the effort that's gone into it, it'll be 3 years in April, despite 3 years of work and effort and improvement, Monero is still a very young project. There's still just a truckload of work to be done. And on a weekly basis, we have new contributors pitch up and just start working on things, which is like that to me is an indicator of success in my mind, far more than any change in price. You know, people actually want to work on it. And the increase in transactions, you know, is an indicator that people actually want to use it, which is really special to me. And I guess one of the goals that myself and the rest of the core team have always had.
So I'm sure like price isn't the thing you focus on, but what happened in, I guess, August, September last year that explains the big pump in the price?
I mean, for the longest time, I've been telling people don't buy Monero. Don't buy Monero unless you have a use for it. And there's a very valid reason for that, because buying Monero is not the same as buying shares in a company. You buy some Monero, you don't pay my salary. You don't pay anything at all. You're just doing it to enrich yourself. And yet, when people do buy it because they have a use, because they have a reason to use Monero, not only do they help Monero by contributing to the anonymity set because they're transacting with it, but they also increase the demand for Monero because there's actual utility. So something that happened towards the end of the middle-ish of 2016, so August, September, was there was interest from the fabled dark web, which was, you know, supposed to be our origin story, but is now the destination, not the beginning. And an email provider called SigaInt kind of started the whole thing, and they set up a Monero node on Tor. If you visit the website for the Monero node, they have this scathing write-up where they basically destroy Zcash and Dash as being privacy projects that they would never even look at because they don't actually offer any privacy, any real-world privacy. And they also have other concerns like Zcash's centralization and the fact that you're trusting a very small group of people. And so they have the scathing write-up, and then they basically say, so that's why we believe that Monero is the only way to transact privately, or whatever they said, something along those lines, which was kind of a massive pat on the back because, you know, you're talking about an entity on Tor. You know, if anyone has the ability to to control and manage their OPSEC, it's a group like that. And so for them to put this up, to host a Monero node that's accessible on Tor, and then to have this whole big write-up, was kind of a pat on the back because it showed us that, you know, we weren't completely idiotic, and we did kind of know what we were talking about, at least from the perspective of people running hidden services on the dark web. This created a bit of a stir in the seething underbelly of the internet, for want of a better term. And shortly after that, two darknet markets, Oasis and AlphaBay, added support for Monero. And there are always going to be critics, and there are always people who are like, oh, look, they're just pumping Monero or whatever. But at the end of the day, it again was a bit of a pat on the back because it was recognition of the work that we'd been doing to enhance Monero's privacy, which is the very reason for Monero's existence after all. Oasis ended up exit scamming shortly thereafter. And who knows, maybe AlphaBay exit scams or whatever. But the fact of the matter is, in spite of all of that, there's been an increase in real-world use of Monero. I mean, it's everything we've ever hoped to achieve. And now we're seeing people use it. We're seeing a pickup in purchases on AlphaBay, or that's what they told Carl Torpy in a Bitcoin magazine article. And we're seeing an increase in transactions with Monero, which it appears to be more driven by actual usage than by speculation. So I guess, like all things considered, it's pretty much exactly what we want to achieve.
How accessible is using Monero to do things privately? How much of a tech-savvy person do you have to be? What do you need to know?
Download the GUI and run it, and that's all you need to do. There's literally, I mean, the GUI is so easy to use. We have a second beta of the GUI coming soon. The first beta was still a little rough around the edges. The second beta improves that. I wouldn't say it is it's friendly to the point where I would recommend new users who are unfamiliar with crypto start using it. But definitely anyone who's used a Bitcoin wallet before will immediately they'll understand some of the concepts they don't understand. They can go and ask about or Google or check the Monero Stack Exchange. But it really is from a wallet perspective, relatively simple to use. And that's all you need. You download the GUI and off you go.
Gotcha. Now I'm going to expose my lack of knowledge about dealing with dark markets, but you'd still need to use Tor to access the sites if you're going to buy something?
Yeah, I mean, if you wanted to buy something on a dark market, sure, you need to use Tor to access the website. The thing with Monero is that it's not like you're forced to use it on dark markets because it's the only place you can.
And I'm sorry to put you in that box.
No, that's completely fine. A lot of people, like Peter Todd, for example, uses Monero to protect the privacy of his Bitcoin transactions. So he uses services like Shapeshift and XMR2 in particular, and he takes a small portion of his Bitcoin, turns it into Monero, and then he holds it in Monero. And then when he needs to pay for something, he uses XMR2 to pay from Monero to Bitcoin. You don't need an account and you don't need anything. It's just this website that you visit and off you go.
XMR.to.
And that's it. You go to XMR.to and it asks you for the destination Bitcoin address that you want to pay and the amount. And you punch that in and it says, okay, here's the Monero address and the Monero amount that you need to send. And you send it and off it goes. It does its thing. So it's and there's no need for an account and there's no need for anything. It's quick, easy, and it protects your privacy because that's sort of their focus is on the single channel from Monero into Bitcoin, continuously protecting end user privacy.
Is that like matching up orders somehow, or how is it working?
They pre-convert, so they'll hit Poloniex or whatever. They'll convert Monero into a bunch of Bitcoin and they'll store the Bitcoin.
Ah, okay.
When you use them, you send the Monero to them and they'll go and make a payment.
So they make a little percentage on that or something?
Yeah, they have a small fee. It's slightly smaller than Shapeshift. So it's useful if you are going that one way. But that's literally the only route that they offer. They don't offer anything else. But it is useful for Bitcoin users who want to use Monero. Like they don't want to hold Monero. They don't care about Monero's price. What they do care about is having a little bit of Monero so that when it's time to make a Bitcoin payment, they can use that. And then they can go and refill their Monero pool at their discretion whenever they want.
So someone would see you sending Bitcoin to them, but then have no clue what's happening next, I guess.
Exactly. If law enforcement had to go back to XMR.2 and say, who did this? They would say, well, we don't know. We can't tell where it came from or what their address is or anything.
You need to be doing something to obfuscate your IP address or something, I guess, to be really safe? Or?
Yeah, I mean, if you really wanted to, but again, like XMR.2 have been pretty good with, like they don't store logs, access logs or anything like that. Obviously, I mean, it's as with anything, like somebody can promise they don't store access logs and then meanwhile they do. So yeah, like the recommendation always is if you need to go down that road, then, take steps to protect your identity, whether it is using a Tor or a VPN service or whatever you choose to use, at least like have one level of disconnect. It's pretty unlikely that even with rudimentary OPSEC, you'd end up getting some sort of link back, because it's the connection between your IP address and the transaction is so... it's so vague, so you visited the website. Okay. And then what?
Got it. Yeah. No, that makes sense.
It's not a strong connection. Like, well, we know it came from this address and your IP address is the first address to broadcast it. So therefore.
Do you feel like talking about controversial views?
I'm happy to talk about controversial views. Wait, I got to grab a glass of water because otherwise my voice is going to die. Give me half a second.
So you might be realizing that we're kind of halfway through the interview, but we're pretty much all the way through this MP3. So what's going on? Well, joke's on you. You've been duped into listening to half of a two-part episode. Stay tuned for the next exciting episode of The Bitcoin Game. You'll hear Ricardo and I go over all kinds of stuff. Until next time, I'm the BTC Game on Twitter, and you can email me at rob@thebitcoingame.com.
I need to sort of go back and look at the number of transactions they needed to create.